When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and welcome to Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognise, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. In this episode, I speak to Brother Richard Hendrick.
There's a wonderful story in our tradition from way, way back about a young monk who goes to his Abba, his elder, and he says to him, you know, I've been doing all the work. Like, I'm doing the meditation, I'm doing the manual work, I'm fasting, I'm doing everything, and I still haven't found that deep contemplation that you're all talking about. And the Abba says to him, come with me. And he brings him up to the top of the hill at dawn, and he looks out at the sun rising, and he says to him, tell the sun not to rise. And the young monk says, what are you talking about? He says, tell the sun not to rise. So the young monk says, don't rise to the sun. And of course, the sun rises. And he turns around to the Abba and says, what's all that about? And he said, is there anything you could do to stop the sun from rising? And the young monk says, no. And he said, in exactly the same way, for every human being, eventually the sun will rise. So the young monk says what we're all thinking, which is, then why am I doing all the work? And the Abba says, so you'll be awake to see the sun rise.
Brother Richard has been a priest friar for over 20 years, and he's just released a beautiful book called Still Points, a guide to living the mindful, meditative way. In this conversation, he gives us a fascinating insight into the life of a monk. He also explains the difference between having purpose in life and finding meaning. He speaks of Celtic spirituality, the power of apologizing, and death in the most beautiful way. It's an episode that'll make you reflect on your own life and hopefully enrich it, as it has for me. Here it is. Brother Richard, thank you so much for being here today to have this conversation. I'm delighted to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a privilege.
So let's start with, I suppose, the obvious.
Sure.
You're a monk. You're
yes.
a brother.
Yes.
Why did you decide on this life?
It's the big question everybody asks. And I suppose it changes over the years and with the telling and with more kind of reflection as you look back. But in a short way, I suppose the story is I was heading for college. I was finishing secondary school. My plan at that stage was to go and study biology and to specialize in zoology. So the sciences, that's what I was heading for.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I was kind of asking some of the deeper questions, you know, the what's it all about questions.
Yeah.
Came from a Catholic family, not in an overly devotional way, just the ordinary Catholicism of the 70s, 80s. And around about that time, somebody handed me a book on St. Francis. And to this day, I cannot remember who it was gave me the book.
Okay.
So some little messenger along the way. And I began to read about this man, St. Francis of Assisi, a medieval saint, but someone whose vision is still extremely fresh. Someone who believed in living the gospel life, but in a joyful way, in a peaceful way. Most people would know him because of his association with the animals and nature. Mm. And I suppose that also kind of reverberated with me as someone who was interested in the natural world and who found great peace in the natural world.
Mm.
And I began to ask myself, well, okay, that was great for St. Francis back in the 1200s, but, you know, did he still exist somewhere? Was his vision still around? And in those days, pre-internet, so it was the library and the phone book and all of those kind of things, and found the Capuchins, the Capuchin Franciscans in Church Street, where I currently live now, actually. And I phoned them and said I was interested, and they said, well, come in. And then they asked me how old I was, and at that stage I was 16. So they said, too young, but if you want to come and visit, you're more than welcome to come and visit. So I did, and had an extraordinary sense of coming home. A real sort of spirit movement of just, you know, if I had been told you could move in there and then, I would have. And that's 30 odd years ago now. So since then, you know, there have been the ups and downs and the ins and outs and the joys and the sorrows, like every human life. But it has remained with me as a sense of home. And that's something that kind of holds me there.
Mm. Wow. I'm trying to put myself in that situation where something at such a young age feels so right.
Hmm.
And that's just what you got. Was it a feeling of safety? This is, wait a second, I'm meant to be here.
Not so much safety as almost a kind of a, in some way my soul lived there already.
Right.
There was a kind of an echo of some description. It's very hard to put it into words, but, and of course, you know, that's a feeling, and feelings come and go. But it was certainly something I found invitational, that wanted, that I felt I really had to kind of experience. So I was left with a kind of a decision then. And at that point, I went to a friend of mine who was a priest, and I asked him for advice. And he said, go to college, get your degree, do whatever you're going to do, and then look into it. And then I went to another priest who was also a friend of mine, and he gave me the exact opposite advice, which was, go in now if you can, if they let you, and get it out of your system.
Okay.
And that way then it won't be hanging over you in college. So I said, well, that sounded more logical. And I applied and went in. At that stage, I was 17. We don't take people in that young anymore.
What's the age now?
Oh, it'd be 22, 23, 24. Beforehand, because emotional maturity levels have changed, particularly with young males over the last 20 years, but that's another conversation.
Right.
So
were you mature then at that age?
Well, they thought I was.
Okay.
I passed all of the various tests. I mean, we're examined in and out, and not just from a kind of a faith or spirituality end of things, but to this day, anybody coming in has to pass a psychological and a psychiatric assessment.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
What are we talking?
Sure.
Just like interview process almost?
Interview, a number of interviews. There would be a full medical done, all of that kind of stuff. Because the life, the monastic life is it's tough.
It's tough.
It's tough physically. There's a certain asceticism to it. You're living in community with men of all ages, and very often all cultures, all nationalities. We're quite an international group. So there is a certain psychological equanimity needed in order to kind of approach the life and to deepen your awareness as part of the life.
And then the restriction that obviously goes with it when you come from modern living,
sure,
as it were.
Sure, yeah.
You know, I know the codes of conduct that you live by would be obedience is really important. You vow poverty, the obvious one then is chastity.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, that is for a teenage lad.
Yeah.
Is that really hard?
I suppose it's interesting. You go in, most people on the outside would think that it's poverty and chastity are the difficult ones.
Right.
Actually, if you're choosing to go in, you know that you're going to live this way. What's really difficult for most people nowadays is the vow of obedience.
Really?
Because it means in a world that's constantly telling you to be an individual and to do your own thing and to follow your bliss and all of that kind of stuff, you know, to suddenly realize that you're putting yourself at the service of a community is different. And also that...
your needs are secondary?
Your needs become integrated to the needs of the community.
Mm,
so it's about balancing your needs with the needs of others. Just as in a family, if everybody does whatever they want, a family's not going to function. Mm. You know, there's a certain amount of give and take. And
a lot of families don't function.
Well, this is true. and I mean, sometimes we don't function. you know, so but there is a kind of a give and take and a constant reference to kind of reflecting on how am I fitting in. Yeah. And then when somebody comes in, they're not sort of in from the first moment. It's a long period of training. It's about 11 years for us. And it's only after 8 years that you would make your kind of vowed commitment fully at that stage. So it's, you know, it's a long engagement before the wedding. So there's a lot of getting to know you, and the order also sort of inviting you to get to know them, and experiencing kind of a lot of different apostolates and work, and seeing kind of where your talents lie, where your gifts lie within that. So, yeah, it's a very different journey than most people would be on nowadays, but it still attracts quite a number. Yeah.
Yeah. From your experience down through the years, you were saying 30 odd years now as a brother. Have you seen a lot of people come and go?
Oh, yeah. And we expect to. Yeah. We expect to. Like the absolutely normal rate for those who would come in is about 50% stay and about 50% go.
Okay.
And both of those we would consider successes, in the sense that if you come and you try and you discern through your trying that actually this isn't for me, that's a grace. That's a gift. It's a success. And the gift of having lived in community and maybe been trained in these reflective disciplines, you take with you into the rest of life. Whereas as those who then come in and stay, even though like any commitment, you're committing maybe in a formal way or in a public way, the commitment really is a daily experience. It's getting up each day and saying, I'm choosing to live this way, you know.
And are the days when you wake up and you go, not sure about this
of
anymore.
Course because right. You're a human being, you
yeah,
know
yeah yeah
like if that wasn't happening, there would be something wrong.
Okay.
Because it means you're not actually living with the ups and downs of life properly
and being authentic.
Absolutely. And authenticity in anything, whether it's monastic life, a relationship, a job, means there will be days when you stand back from it and go, what am I doing at all, you know. And that's really important to have, as long as that's held within a matrix of good deep reflection and self-awareness. Then that should lead you to a point of either recommitting fully or being clear enough to be able to say, actually, this part of the journey is over for me, and being able to deal with that properly.
So after your 11 years, what is the process then of the ultimate? It's a, you know, you're rubber stamped, you're official now.
Yeah.
Is there a ceremony?
Yes. So there's after year 8/9, it's slightly different depending on each individual. Everybody's taken as an individual themselves. So if some people feel they need longer, they receive longer, you know. But after the sort of 8th, 9th year, you make your vows publicly. We call it solemn or perpetual profession. It's the equivalent, I suppose, of marriage in that sense, that you're making your commitment publicly.
Yeah.
We would already be wearing the robe at that stage, the vows are made publicly, and you know, like any celebration, there's the formal ritual church part, and family and friends would be invited to that, and then there's usually a meal or a party after that to celebrate that. But it's more about what happens the next day. So in the next day, you recognize that the practice is about not just the great day of the vows, but beginning again each day and formally renewing the vows each day, and kind of, you know, recognizing that you're now in a kind of a lifetime journey into an inner discipline, an inner experience.
I find it absolutely fascinating, and I have huge admiration for you and anyone who whether it's a calling or it's a choice or is it a bit of both. As you said, it's not easy, and it requires a lot of self-discipline. What would a typical day be like now in your world, or is there such a thing?
I mean there are certain things that happen every day, so maybe just to go through those. So I get up about 5:30. We have meditation and prayer then silently.
Now, I'm thinking 5:30. Is it the alarm on the phone going off, waking you up, or is it the sound of a bell?
Sound of a bell on the phone.
Oh, okay, right.
So that's what wakes. You know, we get up, silent meditation together. Then we celebrate Mass together at 8 o'clock, 8 a.m. After that, we gather in our own private chapel and we have some of the psalms together. And then Some people have breakfast much earlier, some people have it round about then, but that's breakfast. And then you're into work, whatever the work would be. So at the moment, I'm looking after a parish, an inner city parish called Halston Street. So there's a lot of work with that, all the usual stuff, baptisms and funerals and weddings and all of those kind of bits and pieces, and the daily kind of care of the parishioners. And then I would also do a little bit of teaching and a little bit of work with the Sanctuary Spirituality Centre in Dublin that was founded by Sister Stan. So on occasion, I'd be teaching courses there as well in terms of meditation and contemplative life. We gather for lunch at 1 o'clock. If you're in the house, if you're there, we've a meal together. And then the evening, at the afternoon is work again. And then you're back to prayer and meditation at five. At 6 o'clock, quarter to six, we gather for the Psalms again. We call that Vespers, evening prayer. And then the evening is kind of quiet. Some people would be working, might have evening services. You might be seeing people that are calling, looking for advice or help or assistance in some way. There could be other groups going. Usually we would gather we have a sort of a common room, a lounge area. So we gather, just share the day together, look at kind of what's happened. Chat over things. Some people would watch the news or whatever it might be. And then there's quiet time in the evening for reading, prayer, study. And I'd normally get to bed around midnight or so. So that's that's the average day. Yeah.
Okay, so that's not a lot of sleep, is it? Midnight to five, you know what I mean?
No, but I suppose it helps. I'm a natural insomniac anyway, so that's okay.
Yeah,
But we also have, over the years of working with meditation, meditation begins after a while to actually replace sleep. You're able to rest deeply enough in meditation that it's restorative in a way that sleep actually isn't. So yeah, it begins to work with that, yeah.
I love yoga, so I love yoga nidra. And you do get that feeling of rejuvenation.
Absolutely,
Even though your awareness is still switched on.
Yeah.
Although I will admit that often I can doze.
Oh yeah, sure.
Have a little sneaky nap.
We've all done that. But I suppose any of the meditative disciplines begin to teach you that there's kind of a third way of being. Most people go through their life either awake or asleep, whereas whether it's yoga nidra or meditation or mindfulness or prayer, what that's showing you is that there is a third state possible for the human being, which is relaxed awareness. And that's what most people long for. You know, they have a deep hunger for that, but they don't necessarily know how to get there. Whereas these particular disciplines offer techniques that allow us to arrive at that place. And it's very restorative and very healing for people to actually know that they can, most of the time, at least, if they're not too distracted, they can tune into that relaxed awareness that's a natural state within them at any time.
I'm trying to imagine the listener now, because if I'm feeling it, other people are as well, because, you know, that is something that a lot of us, myself included, strive for.
Sure.
But often we live our lives in autopilot. And it's only when you catch yourself, say if you're driving along the road, and you realise you've arrived at your destination and you've gone, how did I get here?
Yeah, sure.
It's that feeling of, where was I?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm here and I'm safe.
Yeah.
And
clearly, hopefully
everyone else is. But I don't remember that journey.
Well, the functional system is working at that point, you know, and as a result, there's a kind of a detached awareness. I wouldn't necessarily call that meditative awareness as such. I think meditation, when it's done right, one is deeply aware of what's going on internally and aware of what's going on around you, but in a relaxed way.
I would imagine like being on autopilot, like even though it does happen, it's what I'm trying to say is, I suppose, is it's not necessarily a good thing. What you want to get is that sense of aware. Like, do you have that, I am fully aware at all times now? Is it a training that your body, your mind, your soul is used to?
I certainly wouldn't say at all times by any means. But I would say there is a depth of awareness that the meditative practice brings, which is with us most of the time. Yeah, and that's nothing special about me. It's literally any human being who does the training will be in exactly the same way, you know. So it's and there are lots of people of lots of different traditions and denominations and all of that that I've met along the way who have exactly the same thing because they've practiced. And that's the word. It's just when you put the practice in, the ability appears then at that stage, you know.
We've had a lot of conversations about meditation on this on this podcast because I suppose I'm into it. There are times when I let it slide.
Sure.
And then I reach a stumbling block and then I'm trying to, as they say, kind of crisis meditate my way out of it.
Sure.
It's the practice.
Yeah.
The kind of the, you know, the daily practice of it
yeah.
that actually will help you navigate yeah. the bumps in the road.
Sure. It's not the panacea or the cure, and it certainly doesn't stop you feeling any of the difficulties. In fact, very often you have a deeper experience of whether it's joy or sorrow. I remember teaching one course and there was a lady on it. And at the end, she said, you know, I don't like this. And I said, why? And she said, well, I came here, you know, kind of broken. And now I'm just aware that I'm broken. And I said, well, that's exactly what you're supposed to be, because it gives you that deep awareness that you can then use as a kind of a starting pad or a launch pad to actually begin to change things and operationally change things. The idea that meditation is, you know, the closed eyes blissed out on a cloud somewhere, it's the direct opposite from what meditation is. So it's great if you're resting and you get that occasionally, that's fine. Most people do receive that kind of occasionally. But really what we're talking about is beginning to live life from the depth dimension of the being rather than the kind of surface living that most of us live on most of the time. And we kind of have to, you know, most of the time. But if we have that depth awareness, we begin to catch patterns of behavior. We begin to catch inner habits. We begin to look at the inner voices that may not necessarily be our own voice. They can be the voice of parents and teachers and, you know, people of old that are kind of speaking in our mind. Mm. We had one really interesting experience some years ago in the sanctuary where I was teaching teachers how to teach meditation to young people. And we had one little experience we do, which is what we call a mindful piece of chocolate, where we give the children a piece of chocolate or a raisin, depending on what they want or what they like. Most of them go for the chocolate, but in these allergy conscious days, we have to have both options.
Yeah.
And they do a very deep sensing experience. Most people who've done any kind of mindfulness course will know it. It's a very deep sensory experience. And we had one teacher who, at the end of it, when we were checking in with people and saying, you know, how are you after that experience? She said, I'm angry. And I said, why are you angry? And she said, you've just taken chocolate away from me. No, I've just given you a piece of chocolate. And she said, no, chocolate's gone from my life now. I said, why? And she said, I've realized through the sensing that actually I don't like chocolate.
Wow, right.
She said, my body does not like chocolate. But she said, my habit had been, she would come home from a busy day teaching in school, primary school. And she said she usually had about an hour at home before her kids would come home. And then, you know, all of the chaos of the evening would take place. So she said that was her moment where she would sit down and she would make herself a cup of coffee and have a bar of chocolate. And she would just, that was her little moment to herself, you know, good job. You know, I've gotten through the day this far. And she realized by doing it that she had a very clear memory of her mother years ago saying to her, stand still and be quiet. And if you're good, I will get you chocolate. So the chocolate was the reward from mum for good behavior. I'm a good girl. I'm getting chocolate. That over time became, if I'm a good girl, I have to have chocolate. And that finally became a sensory cue of, if I'm eating chocolate, I will feel good about myself. Whereas when she sat into the meditation, her body actually went, I don't like chocolate. Mm. So we talked with her and we worked with her. It was a fantastic experience because she had really done the deep reflection work and the wisdom that was within her that she had repressed through, you know, being too dominated by the previous voices or previous experiences or long repetition of the same behavior, that cleared. And she decided she was going to go home and have the cup of coffee and she'd find something else to have with it, because she knew she didn't need chocolate anymore to tell her, good girl. Now, we're all like that. We have layer upon layer upon layer upon layer of behavior that's gone in. Most of us, I mean, pretty much all of us, popped into this world as a blank slate. Mm. So everything that we experience as us, at least on the surface, has come from somewhere. So what meditation does, it allows us to slow down enough to be present to that and just ask the question, where have you come from? Mm-hmm. And then the next question, do I need you? That changes lives.
Yeah. I'm even just asking myself that right now, because that's so huge.
But what's very often interesting with meditation is the stuff that you don't want to see, very quickly you realize, you know, it's probably not you anyway.
Mm.
It generally has come from others. I mean, I do a lot of work with young people with regard to meditation. And what we find is the amount of you know, pressure, external influence, etc., that's coming in from media, from social media particularly, all of that kind of stuff. It's no surprise to anybody. It's part of the conversation of the moment. But we forget that it's actually integrated as self for a lot of them if you don't have the reflective practice, the reflective gap. So we were finding that where we would say, you know, you pick up a book and you read it and you think about it and you have time to think about it or to decide, was it a good book? Was it a bad book? Would I recommend it? Whatever it might be. Whereas the pace of media and particularly visual impression that's coming in for most young people meant there was no reflective space. It's constant. It's ongoing constantly. And so we speak of things like, you know, FOMO and all of that kind of stuff and all of the anxiety that's there about I'm not in charge of the content flow. I don't know where it is. But we have never actually set a reflective practice in place for young people that allows them to actually interact with it on a kind of a value basis. Is this of value to me or is it not? Is this making my life better or is it not? And so it was only when they had experiences of things like fasting from social media as opposed to fasting from food or drink, which they often found much harder than fasting from food or drink. That was when suddenly little lights of awareness would begin to happen, you know, and they would begin to recognize that actually I might need to look at what I'm letting in. Mm. And again, meditation can help with that as well.
I have found that when I've done, say, a retreat, and I've done, you know, a number of them down through the years, where there was one in particular where, you know, we voluntarily handed our phones over at the beginning of the few days. And I was reluctant.
Sure.
I struggled with it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And by the end, I was almost reluctant to get it back.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I loved...
Yeah, the space.
The space.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we always say is like social media, the internet, all of that stuff, like it's not good or bad. It's simply a tool, you know, and it's about how you're using it. Are you using it skillfully or are you using it in such a way that's liable to damage yourself or others? You know, we don't put a chainsaw in the hands of a 10-year-old. But most 10-year-olds now have access to stuff online that you would never think a 10-year-old is ready for or suitable for. Neil Gaiman, the famous fantasy writer, put it beautifully. He said, we opened the libraries of the world, but we forgot to put a librarian in place. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that we need to sort of learn and we're kind of catching up on is we all need that inner librarian who's able to say, this is what's appropriate. This is what's necessary at the moment. This is what's actually going to make your life better. And actually, you're in the wrong section at the moment. You need to be over here, you know? Mm. And that's a skill that needs to be learned before we're kind of drenched in information and in stimuli. I would say most adults even, let alone young people, are completely overstimulated at the moment.
Yeah.
And are living this life of constant exhaustion because they just can't keep up with anything. So that's why I think when we bring in the meditative disciplines that the great traditions, the great wisdom traditions offer, even if it's just as simple a thing as, you know, switching the phone off and going for a walk or immersing yourself in nature or slowing down a little bit or making sure that those slow moments are in the day, that's when we begin to actually allow that reflective capacity to open. And you get real change for people in that moment.
And I mean, I suppose, look, mindfulness has become a buzzword in recent
years. Completely. Yeah, 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 absolutely.
And this is something that you have been intuitively practicing since you were probably even preteen, really.
Oh,
it
sure.
Like you were drawn to it.
But we all practiced it. Mm. This is the thing. Like whenever I teach adults meditation, I always say, you're not learning something new. You're remembering how to do something you've forgotten.
Yeah.
And this is really important. Like the last trimester in the womb, for example, the baby's brain waves in that last trimester are almost exactly the same as someone in deep meditation. Then we're born and we're distracted ever after, you know, from that point of view. But it is something you actually did for 3 months deeply. You were already on retreat, you know, ever before you entered this world. And so it's important for us to kind of just regain that skill. Mm. And physically, our bodies are made for it, you know. There's so much research at a neurobiological level now in terms of what happens when we slow the breath, when we attend to the moment. Like as simple a thing as the prayer posture, which is present in every religion, in every tradition, the two hands together, they have discovered that if the two hands come together and there's a slight pressure, the blood pressure comes down. Mm. I had a really interesting experience some years ago. I was in hospital for some medical issues and they needed to do an MRI. And I hadn't ever had an MRI before. So I was quite nervous about it. And, you know, it was very claustrophobic and all of the things that people go through within it. Anyway, they put me in They were taking the shots, they're talking to you. And they said to me then, look, we need to do about 10 minutes of work here, 15 minutes of work. Do you need music? Do you need someone to talk to you? And I said, no, I'll just mind myself. So I just did meditation and went into the meditative breathing. And about 6 minutes into it, an alarm went off and they started shouting, we're getting you out, we're getting you out. So I said, okay. So they took me out and there were two medics standing there and they said, are you okay? I said, I'm fine. And they said, what were you doing in there? So I said, I was meditating. And one of them said, I told you that's what they were doing. So apparently I was unaware of this, but the breathing and blood pressure had become so low that alarms had gone off in the MRI because this wasn't supposed to be normal. So we ended up in a great conversation about it. But it's just a reminder that our bodies have this capacity.
Yeah.
So if you're involved in something, if you have that relaxed awareness that isn't moving into a kind of a reactive experience, the body will do its own thing and it will bring you there. The mind will bring you there. The heart will bring you there. And whether you're doing that through movement, because there are some people for whom still sitting, particularly in the early stages, is almost impossible. So don't move. You know, do the walk, do the hike, do that kind of thing, the gardening that will actually bring you there. But what we would say is if you can get to that point of a body that's kind of touching relaxation, then sit, then be present, then allow that stillness to be with you.
You speak about meaning versus purpose, as in they're not the same. And I think sometimes we confuse the two.
Yeah. So I suppose purpose can be understood as a list of jobs, a list of activities that I need to accomplish in the day. I get up in the morning, I have my jobs to be done, I can tick them off one by one. I have purposeful activity and it's great, that's fine, it's good. But meaning doesn't come from purpose. And so what you find is people can run for 5 years, 10 years, 50 years in purposeful activity and then suddenly they stop. What was the meaning of it all? What was the meaning of the job? What was the meaning of the life? What was the meaning of the relationship even? What we would say is that if you start with meaning, then purpose will come out of that.
To find your why.
Absolutely, yeah. If you want to call it that. Yeah, yeah. The kind of obsession at the moment with finding the deeper experience beneath the surface is really important. And it's a very hopeful thing for humanity, because every now and then we have this moment in society when people begin to go, hold on a second, we need to look at why we're doing these things. So purpose is only ever received really in a deep way from meaning. Meaning never evolves from purpose. And so what we would be saying to people is to ask those deep, deep why questions. As long as you're pursuing truth, we would say within our tradition, you're pursuing the divine anyway. You're pursuing, the ultimate meaning of all things. So as long as you're seeking that and continuing to ask why, and part of our own discipline, our own meditative discipline, is to ask why constantly. You know, people sometimes have this idea that when you enter a kind of a monastic tradition or something, you're sort of leaving, you know, reason at the door. You're checking your mind at the door. And nothing could be further from the truth. You're expected to develop very deep analytical skills as part of meditation. And those analytic skills enable you then to be able to kind of move in the field of meaning rather than just, I'm doing it because we've always done it this way.
Mm-hmm. Again, I always try and imagine who is listening to this or what might be going on for them. And it's probably a reflection of what's going on for me as well.
Sure.
And when you're trying to figure out your why, how do you then decide, is this a voice coming through me?
Yeah.
Is this my ego?
Yeah.
Or is this really me at my core? Is this what I want? You know, is this a true why?
Sure.
Or is this a why wrapped up in something else?
Yeah, sure. I think there's three little tools that are very useful with regard to this. The first is don't jump immediately. Sit with it, and sit with it for as long as is necessary for you to become calm and still around it, and to see, does that why that's evolving, does that actually bestow a deep sense of peace, of inner peace? Now, there may be emotion around it. That's fine. Emotion comes and goes. But what you're looking for is something that's bestowing a deeper stability or equanimity than you have felt before now. The second thing is check your why with others who know you and who know you deeply. You know, community is very important. That's why we live in community as a brotherhood. You know, there is wisdom around you. And to try and find wisdom people in your life is really important. Not just the friend who'll pat you on the shoulder and affirm whatever you want to say. Mm. What's really important is the friend who'll check you and will say, you know, I don't think that's good for you. Or, you know, have you thought about it this way? Or we'll process things with you a little bit. And if you need to go even formally, whether it's to a counselor or a spiritual guide or a therapist or a priest, or whatever it might be, have those people in your life that you can actually check in with. The third and most important one of all, I think, is that if meaning is going to really move you, then what you'll find particularly is a kind of a path of synchronicity, a path of stability. As you begin to move in a direction that's right for you, one of the things you'll find is that opportunities for that will begin to appear. Mm. You know, we speak of kind of being in the flow. In our tradition, we would speak of moving according to providence, recognizing that there is a providence behind all things. And when we begin to cooperate with providence, with the sort of the divine action that's beneath the surface of life, then we find that things will flow with us. It doesn't mean you won't face difficulties, because very often finding your meaning includes finding the difficulties that will teach you what you need to learn. Mm. But it does mean that behind the difficulties, behind the ups and downs, there will be a deep peace of knowing this is where I'm supposed to be. And that can take years to find, you know, just because suddenly somebody decides, they wake up in the morning and go, today is the day I find meaning. Not necessarily, but you can begin to put the steps and the circumstances in place to find it. There's a wonderful story in our tradition from way, way back about a young monk who goes to his Abba, his elder, and he says to him, you know, I've been doing all the work. Like, I'm doing the meditation, I'm doing the manual work, I'm fasting, I'm doing everything, and I still haven't found that deep contemplation that you're all talking about. And the Abba says to him, come with me. And he brings him up to the top of the hill at dawn, and he looks out at the sun rising, and he says to him, tell the sun not to rise. And the young monk says, what are you talking about? He says, tell the sun not to rise. So the young monk says, don't rise to the sun. And of course, the sun rises. And he turns around to the Abba and says, what's all that about? And he said, is there anything you could do to stop the sun from rising? And the young monk says, no. And he said, in exactly the same way, for every human being, eventually the sun will rise. So the young monk says what we're all thinking, which is, then why am I doing all the work? And the Abba says, so you'll be awake to see the sun rise. Oh. This is the important moment. This is what the work is for. So there are far too many people finally touch meaning about a moment before they pass from this earth. Far too many people. Now, they'll see the sun rise. The light embraces them. I have been privileged in the life that I live to be present at very, very many deathbeds, you know, conscious and unconscious alike. And the one thing I can say is that there is definitely that moment of meeting the light, of meeting whatever it is you want to call it. For me, it's God, but meeting ultimate meaning in that moment. But we can meet it much earlier because it's ready for us at any moment. The moment we turn around to it and say, I'm here. Here I am. The oldest meditation mantra in the Jewish tradition is Hineni Adonai, which is here I am. Here I am. So to say that in our interior spirit, to seek meaning in that way, means we will be awake when the sun rises and we'll catch the light, and then the light begins to shine through us to others. That's the whole point of the work. That's how we find meaning, you know, to be awake for when the sun rises. And that can sometimes mean getting up at 5:30 to see the actual sunrise, you know. So, yeah, it's to be there.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
It's really profound listening to you speak and allowing your words to really land. It's something I suppose personally I've been thinking a bit about recently, simply because my own grandmother passed away a few weeks ago.
I'm sorry.
Thank you so much. But she lived a beautiful life and had a wonderful impact on so many people. And we were blessed to have her as long as we did. She was 102 and 10 months.
My goodness. Wow.
Amazing woman.
Wow.
And she took her last breath on the last prayer that the priest was giving her.
Yeah.
And had a very, like, a perfect passing.
Well, there's a very old Irish custom called reading a death. And one of the things that people would always be very interested in when somebody died, especially an elder like that who dies, how did they die? What happened? What were the last things? So seeing things like the breathing out on the last word of the prayer would have been seen as a very great sign that someone had arrived at that place of inner stability, inner peace, inner awareness, sanctity, whatever you want to call it. It's a skill that many people have lost, because death nowadays tends to be kind of very sanitized and very medicated. Now, it should be medicated when it needs to be medicated, absolutely. We're not talking about needless pain or suffering or anything like that. But the ability to be present and guide people into this world and out of this world was something that was a very ancient skill that our ancestors had and our elders had. And that also included then not being afraid of death in a way that many modern people are. And I think one of the things that the meditation or the meditative life, the contemplative life teaches, is that death is just a natural part of life and it's only transition. Now, your faith tradition can inform you as to what you think happens after that transition. But the one thing we're certain of is we came in and we're going out. So the meditative tradition asks you then to meditate both on your coming in and on your going out. And there's a lovely understanding within the tradition that says the one thing that we are doing all the way through is breathing. And so breathing leads us from birth to death, because as soon as you were born, the first thing you did was to breathe in. And the very last thing you will do will be to breathe out. Mm-hmm. So we exist between the in-breath and the out-breath. So every time we touch our breath with awareness, we're touching that whole experience of humanity, of coming in on a breath and going out on a breath. And no matter who we are, whether we're the poorest person on the street or the greatest celebrity that ever lived, we come in on a breath and we go out on a breath. Mm-hmm. So I think taking the wisdom of, you know, of your grandmother and of her passing so near to you at this time, she went out on a breath, but she went out on a sanctified breath, on a prayer, a breath as prayer. And that's a great gift. Yeah, that's a great gift.
Yeah. Yeah, we were very, very lucky. And it does make me think about, you know, it makes me think about the wise. It makes me think that, you know, what am I doing? How am I doing it? Why am I doing it? Because she was a great example to all of us of what really mattered was kindness, living your life
Absolutely. As
a kind human being
Absolutely.
And being good. And she made such a difference in such a gorgeous, simple way.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's what she basically had it nailed. You know, she knew what it was all about.
Yep.
And I'm wondering, like, do I know what it's about? I know it's a constant learning, and we'll be learning to that last moment that we do take the last breath.
Sure.
And then I wonder about, you know, I'm fascinated by that book, you know, The Five Regrets of the Dying.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know,
yeah.
Am I going to have one of those? Will I have that moment before I take my last breath wish I had, you know? And I suppose you want to limit that for yourself and for those you love.
A regret is an experience that hasn't become wisdom. I think that's one of the most important things to recognize, is that there will be things you will do and there will be things you will not do in life, which looking back at you would feel you should have done differently, whether for positive or for negative. They will stay with you as regrets unless you welcome them as wisdom. So in other words, they begin to teach you how to be in the future.
Mm.
So
that requires vulnerability.
Absolutely. And it also requires an inner honesty. And that's something we grow in day by day, moment by moment.
Not everybody gets there, though.
I think everybody does eventually.
But it could be that last flash.
Yeah.
Before this life ends.
Sure.
And then is that not a case of it was too late?
No. I think everything happens at the time that it can happen for people. And so it might be late in the sense that, you know, you've left a lot of damage behind you, or you're going in a damaged way yourself. But I feel certainly from what I've seen, from what I've been present to, in that last moment or that last flash, there is the deepest contemplative awareness there is. And it's extraordinary how much can be healed just in a moment. A moment is infinite. You know, there's an infinite number of opportunities just in a moment. And that healing takes place, I think, for all of us, unless we are consciously resisting it. And there's very, very few people in those moments consciously resist. I certainly haven't seen it. I believe it exists as a philosophical possibility that somebody can say no to the light. But I think once it comes in, once it's received, it's there. And the other thing I'd certainly say is that nobody dies alone. The great fear we can often have of sort of, you know, will there be anybody there? Will there be anybody there to hold my hand or to be in the room other than the medics or the family or whatever it might be? Again, just from the privileged position of being at hundreds of deathbeds, there is certainly a moment where the room becomes full. And there's certainly a moment where, particularly for those who are still aware and conscious, maybe not medicated, but there is a moment of awareness that, yeah, they're here with me. They have arrived to receive me or to take me with them. And the one confidence I can say definitively about death is that nobody dies alone.
Mm.
So I think that's something to take with us on our journey.
Yeah, absolutely. As you said, it is one of our greatest fears, despite the fact that we can't avoid it.
Mm.
It is as real as it gets. We come into the world, we leave the world.
Sure.
And often you meet people who have been through life-changing experiences, be it maybe an accident where they managed to live from it, walk away from it, whatever the case may be, or diagnosis of cancer. I know my situation, that was my wake-up call when I was diagnosed with cancer.
Mm.
It is like your life is flashing before you because you can't help but go to that scary place
of course,
what if. But the gift that comes from that, and it is a gift, and I'm very fortunate that I'm out the other side of it.
Mm.
Because I know it can be difficult to have these conversations when you're going through a difficult time, but when you are lucky enough to get through it, I see that period of my life as a blessing.
Sure.
Because I got to learn a lot about myself, and it brought a lot of good to my life. And one of the main things is to appreciate being here.
Yeah.
And how lucky we are.
Yeah.
But that fear that a lot of us possess, and I understand why. Now as a mother, I have two children. I didn't when I had cancer. It's kind of different now again because I know how important it is for me to be here, be around, even though none of us know what's around the corner. We all
know
that.
Absolutely, yeah.
But it's a different, and I have to navigate that also. What are your personal fears? Are you aware of any, or have you made peace with them all?
Oh gosh, no. Fear is something you work with every day.
Mm.
I think part of being a human being is to be afraid. And to work through that experience to a place of stability or equanimity or calm. In terms of fear, I suppose that the main fear for me is that in some way I would live this life in an inauthentic way, in a way that's hypocritical or that isn't actually focused on the meaning behind it all. Like, one of the things that is a danger, and it's constantly spoken to us within the tradition, is it's very easy to teach this stuff. It's very hard to live this stuff. And if you really want to teach it, the best way of teaching it is to be absolutely silent and just live it.
Okay.
So from that point of view, that's the best teacher of all, you know? And we all know those people. I mean, you mentioned your grandmother. We all know those people who are living an authentic life, a proper good life. They don't have to be monks or nuns or gurus or teachers or anything else, but the vast majority of them will be those, dare I say, in inverted commas, ordinary people, because there's no such thing as an ordinary person, but ordinary people who are living through the experience of their own life, but choosing kindness, choosing compassion, choosing love, choosing authenticity. And that's something that... that's the great example for me. You spoke of your own grandmother. My own grandmother was, I would say, my first meditation teacher, and she would have roared laughing even to hear the word meditation.
Right.
But she was someone who was present. You know, she lived presently. She lived deeply. She lived in tune with the seasons. She was someone who had a very great discernment around people and around, you know, the kind of the motivations behind people. And she taught me an awful lot in that sense. And it was only, I suppose, maybe 10, 15 years into the monastic life that I was saying, hold on, the concepts I'm being taught here now in very sort of regimented ways, she taught me a long time ago,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
And so there's a mysticism of the ordinary that we can miss if we get too caught up in the kind of esoteric. The most important thing is to actually recognize that there is a stability present in the day-to-day moment, that if we live that deeply, if we search for the why in the ordinary moment, if the person, the next person who meets me, meets kindness and authenticity, then I'm living it. I'm living it deeply and really at that stage. And that's my big fear. My big fear is that I would fail in that, that I would miss the opportunity for that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you're having a bad day, do you try and... you know, protect people from witnessing that, or do you own it and say, do you know what, not having a great day here?
I think it's really important to be able to say that. The most contemplative statement that can be made is I'm sorry, because it actually means you have reflected on your behavior, you are aware that something was not right, and you are trying to bring healing to it. So it's not just about, you know, protecting. I mean, we all have our bad days, you know, we all have the day we get up at the wrong side of the bed or whatever it might be. And okay, there might be days where it's better to, you know, take off into the mountains for a while and breathe and get your rhythm back. But most of us don't have the freedom to do that. We're enmeshed in the ordinary and the everyday. I think having the reflective practices, the moments throughout the day where we check in with ourselves, where we say, look, do I need to adjust that? What's really going on? You know, am I irritable? Is it the fact that I'm having the argument with somebody in front of me that I'm really having with somebody I met 3 weeks ago, you know, or is it a case of I'm just hungry or tired or worn out or whatever it might be? And restoring the self in those moments is really important. But if we have, you know, if we have messed up, and I mess up, I've messed up greatly in my life many times, just like everybody has. The important thing is to be able to reflect on it, discern the wisdom out of it, and to say sorry, to begin again. You know?
I know some people who have a real difficulty with saying sorry. Mm. Maybe they feel like they have nothing to be sorry about.
Sure.
Or they simply can't bring themselves to say those words.
Yeah.
Would you have any advice for people who struggle with putting themselves in that? Because essentially, again, when you're sorry, you're allowing yourself to be vulnerable.
Vulnerable, but not weak. And yeah. I think there's the unfortunate thing is that people see vulnerable and weak as synonymous, and they're two completely different things.
Yeah, sure.
There's a tremendous strength in the vulnerable person who is able to honestly say, here I am. We're back to that again. Here I am. This is me in good, bad, up, down, you know, however you find me, this is how you're finding me. Sorrow also doesn't mean that you become the kind of welcome mat for everybody else to walk over. You can say sorry and still retain, you know, your truth in the midst of that. But I think recognizing the humility of vulnerability, the strength of being able to say, I have messed up. I am sorry. I am prepared to begin again. And I will make whatever amends are necessary within that in a reflective way. That's a very, very strong position. And people who find it difficult to do that very often, the ego is sort of so inflated that they just can't step down from that. Mm-hmm. And so what I'd say to them, if they're listening or if there's anybody out there who's really struggling with it, is, you know, begin by saying sorry to yourself. Mm-hmm. Begin by saying sorry to yourself for the errors that you have committed. It may be even the hurts that you have needlessly brought on yourself. And when you've said sorry to yourself and have encouraged yourself in that way, and you've seen how it feels to actually be vulnerable with yourself, then it becomes easier to kind of reach out to others then.
Great advice. Life nowadays feels, well, particularly, I suppose, I can only speak from my own little pocket of the world and what's going on for me. And I feel like, you know, it's the classic, not enough hours in the day, and you're going from one thing to the next, and trying to carve out a bit of me time is, at the moment, practically non-existent. Sure. And that's purely because I have relocated from Dublin to Galway, trying to find our feet, small children. It's just there's a lot going on. But the importance of taking that time for yourself, because often we can be distracted by lots of different things.
Sure.
What advice would you have for somebody, whether it's children or not? We can be distracted by a myriad of different things. We can be living on our own and be distracted by a million things.
Sure, yeah.
But what advice would you have for somebody who is listening to this and is perhaps going, I want that, but how do I get there? How do I do it? How, it requires discipline, it requires routine, you know, but what advice would you have for someone to say, this will perhaps help?
Yeah, I'd say start with the things you're already doing. So if you begin to say, I've got to change my whole life around, I've got to build a meditation chamber and get the cushion and buy the bells and do all those things, never happen. What's important is starting with exactly where you are. So things like deciding, for this particular cup of tea or this particular cup of coffee, I'm not going to look at the phone. I'm just going to be with myself and my own thoughts. When you shower in the morning, to be really present to the shower or the brushing of the teeth or the washing of the hands or whatever it might be. A Buddhist monk friend of mine famously at a retreat, when somebody said to him, I'm far too busy to do this meditation thing, asked the poor gentleman, but don't you go to the toilet? And he said, yes. And he said, well, how many times a day do you go to the toilet? He said, I don't know, 5 or 6 times. He said, well, do it mindfully, do it contemplatively. And what he was making the point of was that there is nothing that can't be made holy. There's nothing hallowed that can't be hallowed by presence. Martin Buber, the great Jewish philosopher, said, everything is longing to become sacrament. In other words, to becoming a way of encountering the divine. So if we're doing that, you know, simply and gently, rather than in a displaced way, a lot of us are doing 5 or 6 things at once all of the time. You know, we're driving, but we're listening to something else. We're talking to somebody or having a conversation at the same time. We're going shopping, but we've got the earphones in. We're going for the walk in nature, but we bring the friend or whatever it might be. Now, all of those things are lovely to do at particular times, but to give yourself space. And one of the things that we often lose are what we call transitional spaces. So we run home from work and we're straight into the family and we've still brought work with us. One of the practices we used to encourage people to do, especially if they were traveling from a place of work to a home place, was to stop outside the door, sit in the car, stop outside the door and to take just 3 cycles of in-breath and out-breath, in which we say, I consciously leave work behind me now to attend to the people inside. The difference that makes is incredible. Now, there's a lot of people who are now working at home and from home. So it's almost like, well, before I close the laptop or before I leave the room, that's when I'll do my cycle of breathing. And for those who are with children, children are the greatest meditation teachers of all because force you to be present. So again, being present to the child when it says, I need, I want, or whatever, as exhausting as that may be at times, the gift of being present to them is that we begin to see life the way they see it. We begin to experience the newness of things and the experience of wonder. And that goes with meditation. You know, meditation is about actually being excited and in wonder and awe at the world around us. And a child will show you that faster than anything else.
I know a lot of us are allergic to even hearing the word, but I'm going to have to say it, during the pandemic, during COVID times, we had a lot of different experiences of that time. Mm-hmm. Some were good, some were not good. A lot of people experienced challenge and sorrow. Some people experienced a lot of joy during that time. And I know for me personally, during those early lockdowns, it was gorgeous because I got time with my partner and my little boy, and there was daisy chains being made and there were picnics outside and there was banana bread baked and all of that crack. And I'm not trying to paint it as that it was perfect, but it was really good because it was quiet and we got to kick back and switch off and be. I found it to be such a gift. So I will always look back at that time with huge fondness, and I know how fortunate I am that during that period that I didn't experience pain that other people perhaps had.
Sure.
And we all have our own individual experiences of it, but it does make me think of how some people were very uncomfortable with the lack of distraction, and how that in itself was almost like, and I've spoken to other people on the podcast about this, that it felt like, and it was actually Tommy Tiernan that said it, he said it was like being on a giant retreat.
Yeah.
And we were kind of forced into being with ourselves. And that some people might have been reluctant and kind of got on board, and other people were like, nah, don't want to do this. What the hell is going on?
Sure,
Because perhaps I'd never done it before.
Yeah.
And again, it's not a judgment or a...
Yeah,
or a criticism. It's an observation that there were people, and I mean, I did struggle myself. Of course, I did.
Yeah.
But that it was, wow, this is tough. What's this about? You wrote a stunning poem that became a viral sensation. It was shared by Harry and Meghan. I believe that Jennifer Aniston retweeted it. I remember Anderson Cooper on CNN reciting it.
Yeah.
Like this was a big deal. I think it was translated into a load of different languages worldwide as well.
It's 28 at the moment, anyway, and counting. Yeah.
Stunning poem. I'm not going to ask you to read it now, but I'm sure if people are listening, if they're going, what was that poem? The second you read it, you'll remember. It was one of those that just, I think it struck a chord with so many of us.
Yeah.
But now that we're here and we have been talking for some time, we obviously have to mention your latest book that has just been released, Still Points, A Guide to Living the Mindful Meditative Way. And I've asked if you could pick a piece that you could perhaps recite for us now that would relate to what we've been talking about, and I believe you picked something out.
Sure. So the book itself includes sort of instructions around meditation from our tradition. It includes poems, reflections, etc., and it follows the course of the year over the four seasons. So the idea being that someone can either follow it along, read a little bit each week, or just dip into it wherever they can. But for me, poetry and meditation are two sides of the same coin. And I find that one sort of begets the other for me. So very often I reflect on the practice through the poetry, and sometimes then the poetry invites me into the practice. So this little piece is just called Catching Your Breath. Come, sit a moment with me by the road and catch your breath. Or rather, let your breath catch up with you from the place you birthed today as you woke. For rushing into the day, you left her behind, alone. A sacred whisper stirring from sleep at the deep pace of growing things. Too busy to hear her call, you have been without her. Exhausted but searching, panting and gasping and empty. Gently now, receive her back into the sanctuary of your heart and allow her to take her throne there once again. Remember then to walk slowly and deeply into the rest of the day at the slow pace of breath, for you do not want to lose her again and feel only the panicked absence of her grace, all while being pulled into the maze of before and after, where she never truly dwells anyway, except as a stranger seeking your return. For she is the guardian of your soul, and she dwells only here, only now, in this precious moment, a gift of divinity hallowing the temple of our being and uniting us with the divine now. Come, sit a while and catch your breath.
That's what it's all about, eh?
Hopefully. Hopefully, yeah. Yeah, yeah. To have those little moments of just catching up with ourselves, you know?
Yeah.
We can tend to be living a life in many places at once, not all of them even in this time frame. So it's important to gather. You know, the old Christian word for that was recollection. Mm. And if you think of the word, what it actually means is to collect yourself again, to collect the broken pieces and begin to bring them back into one place in one moment. You know, when we joined the order, we were told we had to have to cultivate a spirit of inner recollection. Still endeavoring to do that. But it's a practice that we can all engage in, you know, collecting yourself. Where are you actually living right now? And maybe even more important, when are you living right now? Mm-hmm. So it's important just to find that we actually have an anchor that lives inside us, that brings us back into that moment, puts the broken pieces together. And that's the breath. We can touch the breath. And in touching the breath, we're touching now.
Yes. I think this conversation is going to stay with me for a very, very long time. It's been a real gift to meet you and to speak with you.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it too.
Actually, before I let you go, because I know the book, as you said, you know, it is a guide. It's something you can dip in and out of. And you did mention it there, and you said the word Celtic. You do explore our traditions. Because often, I suppose, we hear about Eastern philosophy, and
sure,
we're very aware of other guidelines in which to live, but actually this land of ours is rich in it itself.
Oh, extremely, extremely deeply. I mean, we have a tradition of spirituality and contemplation that goes back to the very earliest days of Christianity, and even further back into the indigenous wisdom of the country, and both of those in a very unique way overlaid each other and intertwined with each other. Ireland is most unusual in that when a new religion comes in, whatever that religion might be, there's struggle and there's war and there's you know, persecution and all of that kind of stuff. And it seems from a historical point of view that Christianity very gently intertwined itself with the Irish native spirituality. And that has continued all the way through. And so many of our customs and celebrations, you know, the celebrations around St. Brigid or around St. Patrick, around the kind of experience of nature that the early Irish Celtic saints had, the gift that is to the contemplative tradition worldwide is something that's really only waking up. It's really only just being acknowledged in a deep way. I think there's something inherently contemplative in most Irish people, whether they choose to align themselves with a particular tradition or not. There is something there that deeply invites us into living on that kind of Celtic thin space or edge space of this world and the next. Mm. And it's something that I remember an American friend of mine said that he never understood Halloween until he lived a Halloween in Ireland.
Okay.
And he was looking at all of the old customs and stuff that were there. And, you know, my grandmother was again, someone who taught me all those customs of kind of how the house should be prepared and how you lit the candles and you put out the bread and the water and the salt for the souls that would arrive that night. And that was an instrument of blessing and healing for the rest of the year. And he was totally taken aback by this because his American trick or treat style Halloween, even though it has its roots in all of that, they had the ephemera of it, but they didn't have the inner meaning of it. And so I think the more we encourage a return to those authentic traditions, the more we can grow in our own particular way of being meditative and mindful and contemplative.
What did you grow up with in terms of games? Because I actually recorded a separate podcast all about Halloween,
sure.
Ishihauna, and exploring the old Irish traditions.
Yeah.
And even, you know, simple games that we grew up playing that are not necessarily played now, but I feel like perhaps there might be a little bit of a resurgence of bringing them back.
Sure.
But the learning of the why we did it.
Yeah, very
you
important.
Know, which
yeah,
was very
yeah.
interesting, as you said, like the, you know, the water and the salt and the earth.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were... We played them in a game form, but they had a significance.
Yeah, oh, very deep, very ancient. Yeah. Well, there was all of those things. And I mean, all of the old, the everything from the apple bobbing to the mirror gazing to the gazing into the fire and seeing letters and all of the front door and the back door. You went to bed that night, but they were unlocked so that the holy dead could pass through and the family could visit. And you know, all of that sort of stuff that was there. And again, it was something that taught you that the spiritual world and the earthly world are one and the same. They're not separate realities. Everything flows from one to the other. And it also meant that the message of Halloween very strongly for me was that, you know, again, talking about fear, it wasn't that the dark was full of danger or fear. It was actually that this was something that accompanied us and was present to us and lived with us and side by side with us. I lived for a couple of years up in Donegal, and the oneness and the unity of the people there with the land was just a fantastic thing to behold. I remember we had a fairy fort on the land of the friary where we were, and it's kept very safe, and we guard it and mind it. And I was walking with one of the groundsmen who was a real Donegal man one day, and I said to him, what about the fort over there? And he said, oh yeah, we just leave that be. And I said, yeah, no problem, I'm fine with that. And he said, I said to him, would the people around here have much, you know, awareness of the fairies? Like, would they believe in them still? And he said, oh no, nobody believes in them anymore. I said, all right, okay. And he said, you don't have to believe in them, they're there. Which is the best Donegal answer you can get.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting, you know, in the forest up there, when wood would fall or there was dead wood or dead trees, a lot of people had the wood burning stove, so they'd come and they'd collect the wood. But on two separate occasions, trees fell on the fairy fort, and they're still there to this day. Nobody touches those.
Yeah.
They belong to them. You know,
yes, yeah.
So I think there's a gift in our mythology and in our folklore and in our spirituality that invites us into a very deep way of living if we can return to the origins of those things.
And I feel like perhaps we are more interested in it. You mentioned Bridget first. You said Bridget and you said Patrick. And then I've noticed in recent years there's a move towards a resurgence to honor the spirit of Bridget more and more. I feel that more.
Absolutely, yeah. Again, I'm not, this is a plug now. It sounds like a plug, but I have a section in it on Bridget, because I was talking with friends of mine who had never heard of the custom of putting out the Rothrida. Yeah, because the cloak is spread over the land on that night, the vigil night. And there's all kinds of folkloric associations with the previous goddess Bridget and then Saint Bridget herself, and how they intertwined with each other and how one sort of took on the attributes of the other. And that, if anything, shows the way the Irish did it in their mind, how they brought those things together. I think the cult of Bridget certainly shows that. But the resurgence of Bridget at the moment, I think, also speaks excuse me, to a deeper resurgence as well of the importance of recognizing that we are incomplete if we don't have the masculine and the feminine in dialogue, if we don't have the balance of both, you know. And again, the contemplative tradition would be very strong on that, because some of the most important teachers of the contemplative way, the ones who have illustrated it beautifully, either by their lives or by their writings as well, have been the female teachers all the way along. And that's something that has been neglected and needs to be brought back into the fullness of teaching.
Will it?
I think so. I think it's happening. I think it's happening for two reasons. Number one, women themselves are saying it has to, and they're discovering them and putting it out there, which is really important. And number two, I think, like, for example, the tradition I belong to and work within is the Franciscan tradition. But we have two founders. We have St. Francis and we have St. Clare. And St. Clare was the one who, Francis, from the time of his conversion to the time of his death was only about 22 years or so. Clare lived on for another 40 years and was the linchpin of the Franciscan movement. She was the one that they, you know, when they wanted to know what would Francis have said or how would he have done it, they went to Clare.
Okay.
And it was Clare who lived and dwelt in an extraordinary, deeply unitive experience with God for the rest of her life. And, you know, if you don't have Claire, you don't have Francis. You know, it's Claire who brings you through, brings the legacy of Francis through and protects it. So in the same way, if we're looking at the history of Christian contemplation, it's people like Julian of Norwich or Therese of Avila or Therese of Lisieux or Saint Scholastica. Or these are the people who actually remind us that the meditative contemplative experience is often more beautifully explicated, more simply taught and lived by the feminine side, whereas the masculine side has to really struggle with ego in terms of letting go of those obstacles that can be there to the real experience of the depth dimension. Yeah.
Mm. I don't wrap up this conversation, but I feel like it is time because I know you you have another appointment after this. So I will wrap it up. But I want to say how grateful I am that you took time to be here today. And this is a conversation that I will enjoy listening back to very, very much. The very best of luck with the book. It's beautiful.
Thank you. And I'd like to say a formal thanks to the people in Hachette who pursued me and pushed me and nearly bullied me into making sure that it happened. So they've done an extraordinary job of design, and it really is it's something beautiful. And
yeah,
I hope people will enjoy it.
Yes, Still Points. It's called A Guide to Living the Mindful Meditative Way. Brother Richard Hendrick, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I really hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. And if you did, please share it with your friends or family. Or you can support the pod in all the usual ways by clicking follow, giving a rating, or leaving a little comment. You've been listening to Ready to Be Real.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.